stop call. My meth is madness and all the block. I do what I got to be able to breathe. If you can quit your job, then you can do a little freak with me. A punk rock star won't ever change the world, but I can tell you about a couple that changed me. And so tonight, we're gonna fuck shit up. Tonight, we're gonna fuck shit up. Tonight, we're gonna fuck shit up. Oh yeah, oh yeah.
All right, welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. This is Sacmagora. This is another installation of Old Punks Never Die. They just moved to the back, and a biography of Paul Cripple of Reagan Youth. Paul, how are you, man?
I'm good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. A little tired, but I'm doing all right. All right. Well, let's jump right into this. I got two fun ones from a buddy of mine. He goes by the name of Tet. He's an old school punk rocker, and he's, I guess he's played in a couple of bands, and he said he opened for you guys one time, but, his first question for you was, did you make any fuck you money off of Airheads?
Yes, I made Aerosmith money off of Airheads because they said, listen, you're not an Aerosmith money. You're not Aerosmith, so you're not going to get Aerosmith money. But the thing was, this band pretended it was their song, this band D-Generation, which had covered the song, and they're on the soundtrack. And when I found out, like I was married to an actress, and Steve Buscemi was going to direct her in this movie called Trees Lounge. He said, let me call this actor up. He's supposed to be in the movie, and he's in the movie, Steve Buscemi. So she called him up, and he said, you mean that song we filmed 2 weeks ago? So I said, you lied to me. You already filmed it. So I could have gotten like a lot of money from them, but they're really big and I'm really small, and you know, I just tripled money, and that turned into Aerosmith money, you know. And I could have said, how much would it be to reshoot that scene with the song you don't want, you know, and pay me that, and then you could keep the scene without reshooting it with a song you do want, you know. Because they told me, you know, it's between your song and two other songs. And my lawyer even told me that's bullshit. They just want your song. You know, but I didn't know they had filmed it 2 weeks prior to them contacting me about using it. You filmed a song that doesn't belong to you, and now you're asking for permission. I could have raped them. I didn't, because I'm nice. Okay?
Well, but you made good money off it, right?
I made Aerosmith money, and I'm not an Aerosmith.
Yeah. So what? Can't complain too much about it. You know what I mean?
No. And Dave's father made Aerosmith money as well.
Good. All right. Well, my buddy's second question for you was: are you aware of like right wing chuds who are not self aware, unironically using your name as a pro Reagan sort of argument?
I think they are aware. Maybe a few aren't. I mean, they actually believe my band is right wing, but most of them know we're not right wing, yet they want to identify the band as right wing because our music doesn't suck, and a lot of right wing music sucks.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. All right. Well, since you mentioned Dave's father, this is another question I kind of want to go into. If it's, you know, too touchy of a subject for you, please, you know, let me know and we can go on to something else. But I think that a lot of people listening to this might feel or might find it useful or helpful to kind of hear this story. But, you know, last few times we talked about you and Dave getting together when you were young and forming the band. And, you know, Dave seemed like a really big influence on you. And can you talk about like a little bit, you know, like when the trouble started and, you know, how he ended up going down that road and you know, with his, you know, with his death, ending with his death. But you know, how close were you guys at the time? And like, how did that sort of play out over the long term? You know, was this a long time period? You know, was it a slow build, a slow series of problems? You know, was it pretty obvious early on? You know,
we just kind of reconnected, and he was splitting up with his girlfriend, the love of his life. Her name is Susan. Susan would cry and make a big deal if he tried to go and get high on heroin, right? I mean, she never said, Paul, you know, could I talk to you, you know, on the side? And we never had talks like that. I had no idea that was going on. But, you know, we talked about it afterwards. But when she left, and Dave, being the wise ass he was, told Susan, we're having a going away party for you. We're having it after you leave, you know, really mean, you know, come on. You've been with this girl for like, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years, it seems like, you know, and now you're splitting up and you're, you know, you're being like super mean to her. Like, come on, you know, have a little dignity, you know, give her a little dignity. When she left, he started indulging in heroin, and we were working together. We were making deliveries with the van because we had a van, and I mean, when you're not touring, you still want to make money. And, you know, I was a pretty good driver because, you know, I did all the driving. Dave didn't even have a license, you know, but I loved driving. And, you know, he'd be like, all right, we worked, let's go get some bags. And we would snort them and put on the, you know, like he would say, Paul, what should we hear tonight? The Queen record or Cricklewood Green by 10 Years After? You know, and, you know, snorting heroin, Cricklewood Green, you know, put that on. We'll listen to Queen some other night, you know, or put Johnny Winterand on. And we would just lie there and get really high. And that's when we wrote all these new songs. Like, we wrote a shit ton of songs for Reagan Youth, you know, and then we kind of trudged along. Well, now we wrote a shit ton of songs for House of God, you know, a new band. We're going to be grown-ups. We're not kids. We're grown men. We'll take on like a higher authority, religion. It's higher than government, you know, God over government. And, you know, well, Dave could be like that Jimmy Swaggart, and I could be like the gospel band. And, you know, we could even quote the gospel according to Ted Nugent. If you want to get mellow, get the fuck out of here. Then you could play a thrash song, and Dave could talk about atheism, and could have a, you know, like beg for money, like those prosperity creatures only do it in the name of atheism, and you know, do what thou wilt and shit like that. And that was a nice plan, and I thought it was gonna happen. But Dave kept doing more and more bags. I if I did a bag of heroin on Monday after work, and then I did one again on Tuesday, there was no way I was doing one on Wednesday. Felt dirty. Felt like skanky. And I liked it. You know, you bought a bag for $10. You do half of it, and you do some other depressants like shots of bourbon that some girl's buying you at the Ritz while you're watching Hot Fucking Tuna. You know, it's like you feel like you're in heaven. You know what I mean? And it's like, shit, I only spent $5, you know, on this fucking high. But five eventually turned into 10, and 10 turned into 20. And the law of diminishing return was something that Dave never considered. You know, every time you do it, you get less for your money. Every single time you do it, you get less for the money. And he basically fell in love with drugs, didn't care about the band anymore. You knew he didn't care about it when we're recording Volume 2. And he just refuses to show up after he's there the entire time when we're recording music. But when it's time for him to record his vocals, that's when he conveniently just decides to stay home and just snort bags, and he's to watch TV like 2 inches from the screen. And it was just like so frustrating. I didn't know what to do. You know, I'm not equipped to handle, you know, like helping a friend like that, you know, get off drugs. And yes, I said, what do you want me to do? Stay up with you all night and take you to the rehab at like 4 in the morning? Have you waited online outside of like, you know, Beth Israel? I mean, that's shit I ended up doing for myself eventually, you know. But I was willing to do it at the time, and I wasn't addicted at the time. And seeing him get addicted like that really broke my heart. And then he shows up to sing, and the guy he owed money to probably knew what time he's coming home from the studio, because when he got home from the studio was when he was attacked. And I thought he just blew off the record. I had no idea whatsoever that that he was in a hospital. I thought he was blowing the record off like he'd always done it. And I remember after a couple of weeks, Nicky Garrett contacts me. He said he's never come in to fix his vocals, and he's never come in to mix the record. And he's like, do you want to mix it? And I said, no. Because, I mean, I played bass on it. I'm like all over that record. I want him, you know, to do his part, to give it that vibe. And I feel stupid now. I should have mixed it, because I thought he was blowing it off for drugs, but he was in a hospital recuperating from a frontal lobotomy. And I think the humiliation and the shame of being attacked like that was enough to drive him into deeper despair, which led me into a deeper despair. And by the time he died, two to three years later after that ordeal, I was already, you know, doing heroin every day at that point. And I think a lot of it has to do with his upbringing. I remember when he was attacked, his father said, if he only had an older sister like you, you know, that could have led him, that could have, you know, been a good influence on my son. Like, you know, like you had a good influence with your older sister. And I looked at Dave's father like, oh God, what a fucking stupid thing to say. You know, like if you didn't bust your fucking son's balls, if you just let him play like all the other kids were allowed to play, if you let him act like all the other kids were allowed to act, and you didn't treat him like some fucking weirdo, special weirdo, you probably wouldn't be feeling such pain that he had to numb by doing the best drugs. He knew which dealers would be selling, you know, out of a bodega for the weekend, and then it'd be sold, like, you know, two blocks away at a laundromat for the next 3 days. And he would know all these things, like, you know, like all these places. And it was like, Dave, if he made those kind of connections in the movie industry, like he was shooting film at the new school, like he wanted to shoot film. If he worked like that to make movie connections, like he made heroin and cocaine connections, he would have had quite an impressive amount of connections, because who the fuck knew, you know, what spot was selling cocaine but just that weekend? You know, and then it was going to move 2-3 blocks away to another location. And I think it's very sad what happened to Dave, and I'm not surprised now, but at the time when it happened, it's like, you're so smart. You're someone I look up to. I cared about you. You know, I still care about you. You know, all these things were going through my head at the time. But now, through the Monday morning quarterbacking, like, you know, 30, 40 years later or whatever, I could see that, you know, the guy's life was just too difficult for him to ever feel comfortable unless he was sedating himself with monstrous amounts of opioids. And he was on 140 milligrams of methadone. And I said, that's bullshit. They don't give you more than 100 unless you're dying from AIDS. Not have AIDS, but dying from AIDS. And he said, oh yeah. And he took out a methadone bottle. It had his name on it. And it said 140 milligrams. And I think that was his way of telling me, I'm not just HIV positive, I have full-blown AIDS. So yeah, that was like a lot. That's a lot. And I mean, it happened so relatively quick. And I think Dave's, you know, upbringing, so being so sheltered, he wanted to show that he could deal with the street and navigate, you know, the ways of, you know, of street dealing and all that, but he was a total failure at that. I never wanted to be a dealer.
You never wanted to be a dealer?
No, never did. Never appealed to me, never the money. Look, my sister and my nephew, whatever, they're dealers. Look how that turned out for them. I'm not saying dealing's not in my immediate family. Because, you know, I told you about my nephew and how he's in jail for murder. And
right.
Most likely murdered that other girl who was his sister's best friend. He had stacks of $20,000 around his place. And my sister used to go over and grab like 20, 40 grand from him. And I don't know what you call that where you live, but in New York City, that's cocaine dealing. I mean, he had cocaine too. He didn't just have money. I mean, he had a ton of drugs on the table.
How old's this kid?
38 now.
Oh, okay.
So I knew him when he was a little boy.
That's got to be weird to see him as a coke dealer and now in jail for murder, but.
Yeah. And when he reconnected with me, he approached me. And the first thing I said to him was, who the fuck are you? And he said, I'm your nephew. And I was like, oh my God, you know, I had no idea what he looked like, obviously, but I got that bad vibe. That's why I said, who the fuck are you? I could have said, I'm sorry, have we met before? Or who are you? We met, you know, I said, who the fuck are you? You know, that's the vibe I got. So it was probably, I mean, I'm sure he was damaged. Oh, this is interesting. I went to Croatia to visit family. my cousin buried my dad. I wanted to thank him. I stayed with that cousin. He told me my mother and my sister were in that village for the month of May. They rented an apartment from someone, and they didn't visit one relative the entire time. I have a feeling they thought I was going to be there in May because I told my cousin I'm going to go there in May, and I showed up in late June because I'm not good with money. And I brought Beatrice, and he told me when your sister and your mom see pictures of you and Beatrice here, and they're going to be so infuriated, so pissed off. And my it was great meeting my cousin who buried my dad, because our fathers were like twins, even though they were just brothers. They had the same face. They were identical. It was so creepy. And we were both the youngest, so we both treated like shit. And he was treated like shit. I didn't know the war was so close to them, that war in the 90s. And my cousin had to live in a mountain for 4 years with mosquitoes as big as like softballs and fucking, snakes everywhere that you can't sleep, and Serbians whizzing bullets by your head. And he took me to where they fought. He took me to a Turkish fort. He took me to, where they threw bodies down a hole and threw bombs on top of it. And they had pictures of he taught me a lot about the history. I didn't know that. I'd been there like 2 months at a time during the 70s and the 80s, and the last time was like 38 years ago. I thought my cousins were going to be like my uncles, but they're not. And they were like, yo, we know our fathers were maniacs. Like, we know this. And your father, being the oldest out of all the brothers and sisters, must have been the lead maniac. So we understand. And my cousin said this to me, and I never heard it. I never heard it asked of me this way. He said, do you still put heroin needle in the arm? I said, no, I haven't done that since the 90s. My God, like, and the look of relief on his face, and I was like, wait, you actually worried? Like, I had no idea I had family that was actually concerned. And I'm sure my mom and my sister showed up there, after, 20 years ago, and told the entire village, my son's putting heroin needle in his arm, And so my cousin asked me that, another cousin told me, free apartment for me and Beatrice for the rest of our lives, right by the Adriatic Sea, right there. Come live. It's free. I own an apartment.
It's free. Sounds like your retirement plan.
Well, yeah, I have the cancer. If I didn't have the meds, I'd be there. I wouldn't have even left, shit. And because my father was born there, I can easily get a passport. And I wanted to marry her there. And they're like, this is fishy. Two Americans want to get married in Croatia. But if I get the Croatian passport, then I can marry her there without them thinking it's fishy. I'm definitely going to do that. And we're definitely going back there. Beatrice loves my family. I left the guitar there the last time, like 1985. And my cousin took it out and he made it better than how I left it.
Wow.
And that's awesome. That just explains how they are. Yeah. They when you leave something there, they make it better. So when you show up, and they said, why did it take you 40 years to visit us again? And that one cut through me like a knife. I didn't know how to answer that. I was like, oh my God, all these times I toured Europe and I could have just flown and my cousin would have picked me up. And another thing, my cousin that I stayed with, a local, first of all, I'm related to everyone in that village, either by marriage or like this guy's like, oh, your cousin's husband is my father's brother. We're all connected somehow, like here. local who's like your cousin, and he calls himself Bronx, because my father left a shirt there back in the 60s, and it was too big for my cousin. He gave it to that cousin, and he wore it, and it said Bronx on it, so everyone called him that. He didn't call himself Bronx. But yeah, when I brought up my cousin Bronx, that's your cousin Bronx? And one of the locals was like, cousin Bronx is a legend in this village. And I saw him when he took me to the village where he actually fought. And he showed me the burnt out houses, Serbian houses, and there were way more rocks with crosses on the road where Croatian soldiers were, you know, were killed during the war. A lot of death there, you know. But I saw how the locals treated him when he was buying his potato chips and waiting to cross the street. When he's talking to them, they like treating him like a rock star. And he showed me a picture of, you know, his little unit that was in the, you know, that fought. And I mean, my cousins were like, we fought too. It's like, yeah, but you had coffee in the morning. You know, did you live in a mountain for 4 fucking years? That's a big fucking difference. You know, waiting at home, you know, and protecting your home turf is a lot different than going over to where they are and fighting them in a mountain for 4 years, or going to the main city and being with, like, you know, a substantial amount of men and not 20 guys in a fucking mountain, like, you know. But that had to be done. And, you know, I respect him because I know if his father, our fathers were so similar, if his father was the one that came to New York, he'd be the one you'd be talking to right now. And right. I'd be the one that would have been picked. And my mother, when the war started in the 90s, told me about my cousins, the one that fixed my guitar. He's going to the main city to protect it. The cousin, the one that offered me a free apartment, well, he's the one that's staying in the village to protect it. And your baby, you know, the baby cousin, Bronx, yeah, he's going to fight him in the front lines. And she started cackling like a hyena, like, you know, he's going to die. Like, you know, the Serbs are like killing. For every dead Serbian, there's 5 dead Croatians. Like, you know, he's going to die. Like, you know, like my mom was cackling. Like, you know, like they chose him to die. It's hilarious. Like, I didn't think it was so fucking hilarious.
No,
and then he's the legend. He's the legend. And my cousin, my other cousin, is going there from Long Island, but he lives, I think, in Illinois now. He's taking his family and he's going to stay, but not with my cousin, the legend. He's the one that fixed up my guitar. Because even us cousins, like, the legend's got to stay with the rock star. And then the one with the 150 olive trees got to stay with the one who's the college professor. You know what I mean?
That seems to work. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's nice. I didn't know my family was so nice. Beatrice, is my family really nice?
Oh, yeah, they're awesome.
All right. They gave Beatrice a shot of homemade, you know, moonshine.
Oh, yeah.
The morning for breakfast. For lunch and for dinner. And for lunch and dinner, there was always an ice cold beer waiting for her. And they love food. There was like a baby pig on a spit. The chickens, my cousin caught one for me and I petted one and I felt how soft it was. The chickens were probably alive earlier that day after they killed it, plucked feathers and fire roasted it over wood. For us.
Made you feel bad.
The scrambled eggs, the yellow in the scrambled eggs looked different. I didn't feel bad. I ate. Oh, yeah. I mean, when I saw the chicken I petted, I was like, my God, I've been eating you guys. You're so, like, cute. You know, like, when I finally, like, they ran up to my cousin because that's my cousin's chicken, but, you know, I'm hard at a sketch chicken.
Yeah.
So I finally got to pet one, like, you know. And,
Well, I'll tell you, you might feel bad, but
yeah.
It probably had a much better life than the chicken you buy at the grocery store, I'll tell you.
Oh, right, hell now. Yeah. Hell yeah. And yeah. It tastes a lot better. And I couldn't tell
so much healthier.
If he's...
Yes.
I couldn't tell where the skin and the flesh were. They were like so close together. It's not like where you just peel the skin off the chicken, like, you know, like, right. I don't know if he peeled the skin already or the skin and the flesh were so closely like together because the chicken was alive earlier, you know. And there's no stealing there. ACAB scrawled tattoo everywhere, like 13, 14 places,
nice.
A tiny nice. Place. I asked my cousin, do you want the cops here? No! No cops! All right. You know, just ask, you know.
It's good,
a tourist.
Man.
It's a tourist destination. Germans, Austrians, Czechs, Poles and Italians frequent that place. There's no crime there. I don't see any reason for any cops to ever show up. Everyone, it's clean. It's the beaches are very nice. The water is crystal clear. It's really, and the sunsets are amazing, you know. And it's a, you know, tourist trap, so they have a lot of like rave music. Every night I was out to 2 a.m.
Like, it does remind me, like, of an anarchist community.
All right, I asked, so who's in charge of this, like, village? Who's the mayor? No one. You know, like, and I was like, it kind of reminded me of anarchy in that, being that there's no crime or anything, but if someone did try to steal something, I could see that there being no secrets in that village, and whoever did it, there will be a bunch of big guys show up and will take you to that beautiful Adriatic Sea and stick your head under the water long enough until you decide never to steal in that village again. And they don't need the police for that.
I like it. Handle it yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it was so obvious. And like, listen, there were so many signs for free apartments because they're running out of, like, there's only like 4 million Croatians, and I think only 3 million of them live in Croatia. So, like, it's easy for me to, like, get a passport and live there because they want to build up their numbers. And if you want to move there and adopt their lifestyle and, you know, on this Slav life and, you know, like, whatever, put it on the census that yes, you are a Croatian citizen, and you know.
Do I have to wear a tracksuit?
No, they don't. Well, no. All right, you know what?
I'm just kidding.
That's Russians. That's the government. Russians, and they squat. They squat.
The squat. The Slav squat. Yeah.
The Slav squat. Yes. Croatian.
You mainly have to hate Serbians.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Fuck Serbia.
It's funny, the Serbians don't wear tracksuits. The Serbians wear army uniforms.
Oh, okay.
They love the army. Now, my cousin.
I know very little about, the only thing I know is a very cursory understanding of like Tito, the fall of Yugoslavia, and then the Civil War.
So did I. My father didn't tell me anything except when I was little, I said, so we won World War II. My teacher said Yugoslavia was on the winning side, you know, Yugoslavian, right? No, you fuck, no, we lost. You don't know anything. And did he ever explain anything? No. He just said that and left it at that. So my cousin did a lot of explaining, like our grandfather died. He went out like Rambo fighting the Serbs in Šibenik in 1943. And my cousin looked, rolled his eyes and told his wife, explain it to him in English. And there is a man in the village who saw a man who looked exactly like your grandfather in Bielberg, Austria, 1944. And he told the man, if you get back to the village, tell my wife, you know, take care of my wife and my kids, please. Sounds like a man who knew in 1944 the war was lost. He's going to bury his uniform, learn some Slovak words or Polish words and go reinvent a new life. You know, hook up with a war widow and just fucking, you know, just fucking, just live. Because the losers were made to march from Bielberg, Austria to Greece, and they were whipped the entire time. And if you survived, well, then congratulations. You could live the rest of your life. One guy escaped in Serbia and got back to the village, and they tied him to a tree and kept whipping him. And I was like, I get it. I got it. World War II, horrible. You know, thanks. Let's move on to, like, other history. They told me, do you know your great-grandfather's name? And I was like, no. And they giggled, it's your father's name, the same name, same first name, same last name. And this cousin, you know, your cousin, he named your son after your, you know, same name as your father, you know. And they said, there's always going to be someone with your father's name in this village, you know. Like, someone will always have that name, the first name and the last name. Like, it's, like I don't know. They giggled, and you know, it was cute. It was cute how they, you know, were telling me all these, like, things I never knew, you know. And I want to go back again. And, yeah, if I end up there in that nice little anarchist village and live longer because time stops out there. And when you go out there and your cousin is like, look at my fig tree, look at my cherry tree, look at my peach tree, look at my apricot tree. And then I have 150 olive trees, you know. And of course, I smuggled home the homemade moonshine, and they make it with figs, with cherries, with mint, with shit. They make it with fucking everything. And there's no liquor stores because they're always giving out free liquor. And listen, you go there and you eat. Nice meal for me and Beatrice. 25 euros. That's like $30. And they kept apologizing that the price has doubled because of COVID. I was like, so this used to be $15? The mussels and sauce with the linguine and the, you know, what I had with the beers and the shots. $30? They used to be $15. Yes, you know, and the shot, I mean, the beers are $2. And they're, you know, they're, it's like drinking an imported beer, not a PBR, you know? It's like fucking amazing. And Beatrice said that the alcohol didn't make her piss right away. She just had to pee when she got home at night before she went to bed. Like, it's kind of like, it's not that, like, cheap beer that runs right through you, like. So she was happy. You know, she likes drinking. She likes eating. So she likes my family. She likes the war. And she got to wear clothes that she would never wear in New York City. Too embarrassed. Out there, no one's judgmental. She's like, I can't believe, like, no one cares. Like, no, like, they don't. No one's going to stare at you. No one looked at her because she was the only black girl in the village probably in the last 5 years, 10 years. You know, they just, they're very, like, respectful and keep to themselves.
I think I'm going to retire there.
You told me
we're moving to Croatia.
The coast, it has to be the coastline where the water is. Don't go to, like, you know, like, over the mountains and far away. Don't go there. Go to the coastline, the Dalmatian coast, like the dog that's white with black spots. A Dalmatian. Okay. That's what it's called, the Dalmatian coast. Like a Siberian husky is from Siberia. A Dalmatian is from Dalmatia.
Oh, okay. Makes sense. Yeah, yeah.
And listen, that food, they also, like, it's not, yeah, it's heavy on the meat and the fish. But they, their environment, all right, they have a lot of environmental engineers working there. I met like three of them. I didn't see any cops the entire time I was there, but I saw three environmental engineers. And my cousin's son was going to be one, and their whole thing is how to keep this as pristine and clean as possible because the Germans, the Austrians demand it. The Italians expect it that way. And I could see, like, yo, don't ruin this piece of paradise. And Beatrice, when she went away, none of her friends ever heard of that country. And she said she wants it to stay that way. She wants it to be like a hidden gem, right?
Yes,
Beatrice?
Yes.
Yeah, she said yes.
Yeah, it's your little quiet vacation spot that nobody knows about.
Yeah, yeah, and I got and family and a free apartment and you know,
good food, and, cheap beer, yeah.
And time stops, and when you're sick like I am, that's what you want. You want to go to a place where time stops. And no divisive politics. And when I met this girl, all right, listen, when I met my cousin's daughter who was starting high school, sophomore, ninth grade, I told her, you know, the Ukraine, the earliest recorded, you know, inhabitants, you know, historically speaking. And she said, yes, I know the Jews and Greeks. And I looked at her like, how the fuck did you know that? Like, did you watch the Timothy Snyder tutorial, Yale University courses on YouTube? Like, but they teach them that, you know, and because they're taught a very good education, you could tell this girl is a lot smarter than I was at that age. Was very telling. Like, wow, America is easy to get divisive with its politics because people are not informed. The kids there are informed. And also, what's another thing that I could say about the kids? They're very open-minded. They were very, like, happy to meet Beatrice and very, like, adventurous. And I liked that when I saw the girls that my cousin's daughter hung out with, they were having hard liquor drinks at the nightclub. And I assume they're like sophomore. They're in high school, obviously. So I asked the mom, I said, what's the drinking age here? And she said, well, when would you like to start drinking? I was like, I never heard that as an answer to that question in my life. When would you like to start drinking? If that's not anarchist, I don't know what is. What is the drinking age? Well, when would you like to start drinking?
Yeah, that's.
But the way they said it, I was like,
living anarchist right there.
To hear that.
Yeah.
And I wasn't prepared to hear my cousin tell me, Paul, your mom and your sister were here last month and they didn't visit any of us. What did we do wrong? Not Paul, your sister and your mother came here last month and they didn't visit us. What the fuck's wrong with them? That's what you say in America or New York. Your mom and your sister came here to the village last month and they didn't visit not one single relative. What's wrong with them? They don't say that. They said, what did we do wrong, Paul? And you didn't do anything wrong. I think it said sramota, which means shame. You know, they were shamed. They didn't want to see you because they felt shame. I don't know. Like, but you didn't do anything wrong. And they kept saying, we just buried your dad. We didn't do anything wrong. And when my cousin took me to my dad's grave, I saw there were a lot of flowers there. So that was my sister and my mom leaving bunch of flowers and a Saint Anthony statue there. I brought beers because my dad was like, he drank a case of beer day. I mean, so he loved his beers. So I had me, my cousin, and Beatrice drink beer with them and had a final goodbye to say to him, unless I see him one more time. But my cousin was like, I couldn't bury him in the village. I had to bury him in the village next door. And I said, dude, you did an amazing job. Like, please, like, I'm not going to complain. You know, I'm so proud of you, you know? And I was, because when I met my cousin, he was wearing a black tank top. I was wearing a black tank top. He had aviators on. I had aviators on. He was missing his front row of teeth. I was missing my front row of teeth. And Beatrice, like, you two guys are like, you know, doppelgangers. God, you're so, like, similar, you know? My other cousin said, Paul, my front teeth aren't real. It runs in our family. What does? Missing front teeth, Alzheimer's, and cancer. Like, you got the cancer? So does your uncle. Your dad had Alzheimer's? So does his sister. Like, wow, like, I never knew this. Wish I knew this 40 years ago, but I guess they didn't tell me back then. But anyway, it was nice. I'm sorry I sidetracked your conversation.
No, that was great.
My family.
One more question about Creighton. Like, what's the landscape like? Is it a lot of, you know, mountains and lakes?
Right. There's mountains all over. The Balkan mountains in Turkish. Right. Like, Albania has a whole bunch of mountains. Every country there has mountains. I have a Slovenian mother. My cousin said, "Are you going to go to Slovenia?" I said, "No." He said, "I don't blame you. I was just there. It's nothing but mountains." Now, where I was at was on the coastline, like, and right by the sea. As soon as we woke up and ate, we walked for like a minute and a half, and we were dipping our toes in the Adriatic Sea. Right behind the sea is a lake with like 200 species preserved, very important. And then, like, on top of the lake, there's a Turkish fort, and there's the catapult, there's the Turkish bath thing, you know, and they turned into a little tourist spot. And the Serbian houses, it could look like they're building a house if it wasn't for the scrawled graffiti. And no, there were no swastika graffitis. It was just incomprehensible scrawls. And my cousin liked to point them out. Serbian house, like, Serbians used to live there. We burnt the house down, removed all the piping. There's no floor, there's no doors, there's just the concrete outline of the house. And no one has taken over that land. No one has moved onto that land. It's like that land has cooties, you know, and they know which family it belongs to. And I'm sure, you know what, eventually some families will be allowed back who weren't assholes, and ones that were collaborators will never be invited back. But that's going to take a long time. So it was like I said, I didn't realize the fighting was so close to where my dad's village was. My cousin kept putting his fingers together like this, 50 meters away. 50 meters, like, that close. You know, I had to go there and fight. I had to go, you know, and yes, mountains right after that. And he showed me the mountain the army went over and surprised the Serbians by going over a mountain that they thought was impossible to bring an army, tanks, artillery, heavy artillery, you know, I can't say that word.
Artillery.
Artillery over the mountain and down to where they were. That was like, you know, the I think it was called Operation Storm. And it's like they won the war in 3 days. Not that it was easy, but in 3 days it was over. And it kind of disheartened the Serbian people because they sent 35,000 soldiers to take over a town. And they thought it was only going to take 3 days because that's 35,000 soldiers. That's tanks. That's artillery, MiG fighter jets, all that. And the Croatians had I think they had 5,000 fighters. And the 500 Serbian families in this town sided with the Croatians, the old-time Serbians, because that was their town, and there's an army that's showing up to destroy it. And it's not a Croatian army. They're here to defend it, you know? So it was wacky, you know, that battle in Vukovar. And that's where all the war crimes occurred. And I'm sure the Serbians were like, we couldn't. It took us 3 months to take a town, and it took them 3 days to take all the territory back. Like, instead of just taking Flatbush, they took, you know, a third of Brooklyn, not just Flatbush. They took everything in 3 days. We couldn't even take Flatbush in, you know, 3 months. So it was like a disheartening victory. And Serbians always said, we will never give up the Krajina. That's what that area that they call, you know, that they were defending was called, the Krajina. Now they're saying, we will never give up Kosovo. And it's reminding me a lot of We Will Never Give Up the Krajina. I'm afraid that after the Serbian gangsters make enough money raping Kosovo, they're going to leave the Serbians that actually live in Kosovo to be forcibly or, you know, threatened and chased out, you know, just the way it happened in the war back in the 90s. I don't know why Serbians love war so much, but they really do. And, you know, I learned that the Czechs are the most respected out of all the Slavic groups. They were the first to gain their independence as a Slavic nation, the first to be offered Christianity and refuse it. And they remember that because when they did a census, over 70% of the Czech people said they were atheists. And there's a famous battle between Rudolf of Habsburg and Czech King Odoacer. And if that battle had gone a different way, Christianity today would look a lot different than it looks today. I'm going to have a more of a Slavic component, and I'm not saying Greek Orthodox, anything like that, but more Slavic than Germanic. And they haven't forgotten that. And the only people to kill a high-ranking Nazi official, the Czechs, they killed Heydrich, Richard Heydrich, the second in command after Himmler to the SS. So they have a strong military history, and they don't wear camouflage, and they don't beat their chests going around where, you know, we never lost a war, we never lost a war. And they've had generals who've never lost a battle, like Jan Žižka. You know, they've had like an incredible military career, the Czechs. And so every Slavic people, from Russians, Ukrainians, Macedonians, Bulgarians, they all look up to the Czechs as that first Slavic people that gained their independence and have, you know, had the better, the best does Nova always win. That's a historical fact. And Rudolf of Habsburg didn't have the better empire, didn't have the better kingdom than Odoacer of Prague. And, you know, like I said, battles matter, you know. Or, you know, like a Habsburg fact, they have two of the most fortunate marriages in history. And one of them is, you heard of Ferdinand and Isabella. When they got married, Spain became a country. They had five sons, and then their sixth kid was a daughter. And the Habsburgs said, hey, can we marry our son to your sixth daughter? You know, us ruling families, us royalty needs to interbreed. And Ferdinand and Isabella said, sure. But your kid, you know, that kid's never going to be fucking, the kid that they make is never going to be King of Spain, because we have five sons ahead of this daughter. Could you believe all five of their sons died early? And then the sixth kid, the daughter that married a Habsburg, ends up, their kid ends up becoming King of Spain. And that's in the 1500s. And in the 1500s, we know how much gold and silver Spain took out of the New World. And the Habsburgs also became the ruling family of Portugal and Holland, you know, the Netherlands. And those were the three maritime powers in the 1500s and the 1600s. And in the 1700s, that's when they said, fuck the New World. We want our possessions back in Eastern Europe. And they brought their fight to Turkey. And, you know, the Habsburgs started gaining their, you know, their possessions back from the Turks and stuff like that. But yeah, what a fortunate marriage. I mean, and that's history for you.
Yeah, history is a weird thing, especially the colonial period. It was so much fighting and feuding. Yeah.
And you hear Ferdinand and Isabella, well, their kid must have been the next king, right? Nope. What do you mean, no? They had five sons. They all died early.
Yep.
And
probably inbreeding.
Yeah. And who ends up being the Habsburgs? And the Habsburgs have so much fucking money.
Yeah. Right place, right time. Yeah.
They like to talk about the Rothschilds, but be serious. The Habsburgs they have enough gold bars to like pee all over the money the Rothschilds have.
Well, hey, on that note, let's wrap this episode up. Man, this was a fucking really good conversation. I really your knowledge of history is on point. I really enjoyed this. Yeah, you do just fine. So, everybody, I hope you enjoyed this episode. We'll be doing, like I said before, we'll be doing these as long as Paul feels like it or we run out of shit to talk about. And I hope you guys look forward to the next episode. And Paul, we'll see you again next time.
Love you. I'll see you next time. Peace out.
Love you, brother.
Love you.
Hold on. Pause. All right. We're going to break here and then we'll do another quick one if you're up for it.
Sure. We'll do a break and give me like 10 minutes. Let me smoke a bowl.
All right. I'll see you in a couple minutes.
Yep. Groovy. Good convo.